I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, and welcome, or should I say welcome back, to the Indie Football Podcast. I am Ed Mallion. It feels weird to be back in this room.
Well, welcome back to you.
Well, thank you very much. And that is the voice, the unmistakable voice of Jonathan Liu. Jonathan, hello.
Hi. How was Sri Lanka?
A delightful time. A comprehensive series victory. I'm sure those who are interested in the cricket have... it's kind of hard to watch from here, isn't it? Because when it starts at like 4:30 a.m., you can only catch the end of the day's play. So it's not ideal viewing hours for English people. But it's a good series win and fundamentally just dominant cricket, I thought. For a team that you don't expect to do well on the subcontinent, because England just haven't for so long. First win in Sri Lanka for 17 years. Mm. In the subcontinent for 6, I think. And then first overseas win in 3 years. So very impressive. But if people are not here to listen to us talking about cricket, as much as you or I might enjoy that, they are. They're more here for the football. And this weekend you were at, what's the biggest game in the Premier League?
Biggest game... anywhere, really. Oh, well, I suppose you could make a case for Atletico
in Barca. Yeah, Atletico Barca, and in Italy there were some big games this weekend.
Certainly the biggest game in Northern Europe is this.
Miguel was at a game which did not go ahead. He was in Buenos Aires for the second leg of the final to end all finals, River Plate against Boca Juniors, and
very serious business.
Yeah,
and not at all funny.
With that in mind, he's currently somewhere over the Atlantic, probably worrying. He gets very anxious about flying, but he is somewhere about the Atlantic, but he has recorded a podcast section with several friends of the podcast to discuss everything that's gone on in Argentina. So we're not going to really broach that too much, except for Johnny to comment on how he finds it funny that Miguel flew all that way to not see a football match.
Fantastic banter.
So let's start off with Spurs Chelsea, because we've been saying every week, it feels like we've been saying, that Maurizio Sarri's Chelsea are probably not quite as good as their record suggests. And then this was, I think Jack actually said there's going to be one game where it probably all comes tumbling down. And you were there to witness that, basically.
Yeah, the people have been saying it's been coming, and including Sarri himself almost saying that, look, our position in the league is sort of a slightly false position, and we are still nowhere near the likes of City and Liverpool. And whether or not that was a self-fulfilling prophecy, his players definitely seem to have taken that advice on board. And it was a really calamitous performance, about as bad a performance as we've seen from a Chelsea side since what we now memory know as the Mourinho season. It was that bad. The defence was all over the place.
We're allowed to call it that because Antonio Conte called it that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Otherwise, it would be harsh.
Yeah, it would be. But it was... it was shambolic, and Sarri as afterwards called it as he saw it. He said it was a disaster, and it was from front to back.
Jack Pitbrook's report said, if they'd lost that game 7-0, it wouldn't have been an unfair result. You wrote about Mr. Sissoko.
Yeah, you did.
And I guess, he had become, for a club that kind of is notoriously kind of spendthrift and doesn't like forking out cash, they spent £30 million on Mr. Sissoko.
Yeah,
and I think you could largely categorise that as a bit of a bust so far. However, a bit of a new role for him, and he was, I think you described him as a whirling vortex of chaos in this game.
Yeah, but basically he was kind of a one-man thunderstorm. It's interesting. He has been playing pretty well for the last half dozen games in this new midfield role, which is partly born out of necessity because Dembele's been injured
Describe this midfield role to us.
Well, he runs around a lot. he does a lot of running.
He's always done that.
Which he's always done. And he is kind of, I suppose you'd say, an old-fashioned tackler. As with most sides, Tottenham's press starts from the front, and if you get past that first line of press, you are quite often on the run. And Sissoko is really, really good at chasing you down, hunting you as if, you know, you've stolen his children, and just taking the ball off you from vastly improbable angles. There was one moment where he took the ball off Kovacic, despite giving Kovacic about a 10-metre head start, and it was a pretty dangerous chance, and he just scythed in and took the ball off him.
He kind of slid around him, you know, like he went to ground, and then his legs kind of circled around Kovacic to just kind of sweep the ball out.
Right. Have you seen the terrifying figure at the opening credits of Spectre?
Yes.
Like with the giant squid type thing with sort of eight, ten legs. That's basically what happened to Kovacic there. He got sucked into the Spectre, and so Sissoko comes in from what appears to be every single direction simultaneously. And the ball is afterwards absolutely nowhere to be seen. And Kovacic is looking distinctly baffled by the whole shenanigans.
I think Sissoko, you know, for his entire career when he started at Toulouse, he was always a central midfielder, an energetic central midfielder. And basically, I guess it became, not necessarily trendy, the right word, but teams wanted, especially good teams, they fill the centre of the park more with controllers, creators now. Than just guys who run up and down. They kind of went a bit out of fashion. Mm. And you had to stick those guys out wide or at fullback or, you know, just at other positions, essentially. And with the increase we've seen over the last year and a half to 2 years in pressing and counter-pressing, and particularly the focus on how to play with the press, how to play against the press, actually someone like Sissoko comes in immensely useful because he's an energetic midfielder, so he can press, but also if your press gets beaten, he's one of the first guys who can recover.
Yeah, I wonder if that whole thing is coming full circle now, where, I mean, as I wrote, the winger these days is not kind of an up and down player. That's your fullback. And the winger is the guy who needs to keep the ball very, very close to his feet and, you know, possibly cut inside, but use space very intelligently and, you know, play little reverse passes, that kind of thing. And that, you know, bless his little cotton socks, is not his strength. And in the sort of game that Tottenham clearly were expecting at Chelsea, where they would be playing a lot of the game on the counter or themselves being countered, the midfield is often the most stretched part of the pitch. And so I wonder whether we're going to move towards, you know, a new phase of the tactical game where your midfielder once again needs to be your most athletic player covering the most amount of ground.
You've also written about Dele Alli, who statistically is not having a great season. And last year was a bit of a down year for him after his big explosion year. Mm. But you think that beyond the numbers, there's actually a case that he's really come on quite a lot.
Right. So Dele Alli this season, he got a goal and an assist against Chelsea, which brings him to the grand total of 2 goals and 1 assist for the season. And he's had a few injuries, but I think that's off 9 games in all competitions. And so his output has been slowly declining for the last 2 seasons. At the same time, as he sort of admitted afterwards, his game is now becoming a lot more complete, a lot more rounded. He said he's not really thinking about goals and assists as exclusively as he used to. He's playing a lot deeper. Sorry, he's playing a bit deeper, but almost as much of a defensive role as an attacking role, even though he's still quite far up the pitch. And the job he did on Jorginho was quite masterful at Wembley, because as we know, Jorginho is like an exceptional player when he gets to run the game from deep. And what Tottenham did was pushed Dele Alli right on top of him and essentially forced him to do what he didn't want to do, which was to run into the corners and to play the game on the kind of the half turn on the hoof. And Jorginho was terrible.
Yeah, and it was weird because he's had a pretty good start to life in the Premier League. Mm. And lots of people are saying that kind of is, the example of the sort of, this is what people mean when they say, can he adapt to the physicality and the speed of the Premier League? I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think that the Spurs just had a great game plan to deal with him.
Yeah.
I guess there's a lot, you know, any team that's run by that one guy, you know, when Barcelona were immensely successful under Guardiola, then the first teams to really cope well with them targeted Busquets, because that was actually where everything came through in that team. And, you know, any team with Xabi Alonso, you'd always, if you can get to Xabi Alonso, if you can stop the supply to him, and if you can stop him having time on the ball, then you're going to stop the way that team plays. And I think Chelsea under Sarri, but with Jorginho as that creative sort of fulcrum, that probably is the way to play against them.
Right. I mean, let's bring in the NFL analogy here, because if you've got your quarterback player, what do you need? You need people essentially protecting him.
Mm-hmm.
You need to make sure he can't be got at by the big angry men with padding. So when that system works, the likes of Kovacic and Kante and Barkley are almost kind of screening him. For whatever reason, that didn't happen. I think the game was so much more broken than Chelsea would have wanted it. And it still kind of baffles me, and I'm certainly not alone in thinking, what is Kante doing? What is the best defensive midfielder probably in the world doing, not in a defensive midfield position, and a guy who doesn't want to play defensive midfield playing just in front of the back four? Clearly, Sarri's got this vision for how he wants Chelsea to play, and that's how he wants them to set up. But if you can be got at that easily, how fit for purpose is that system?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested. I haven't watched enough Serie A over the last year or so to know, but there must have been people that did this to his Napoli team, and he must have found ways to adapt. And I guess he wouldn't have got this far if there weren't. So it would be interesting to see how that develops, because you know now that in every big game where Man United or Arsenal or Liverpool or whoever are playing against Chelsea, that's going to be their first idea.
Yeah.
I guess is to try and recreate what Spurs did.
The four or the five, I guess, you know, whatever you want to call that sort of player, Jorginho now, Pirlo, I guess, a few years ago, they always had kind of tough tackling 6 and 8
Pirlo and Gattuso, that midfield with Pirlo, Gattuso, Seedorf, you kind of had that balance of everything.
Yeah, or you know, Marquisio at Juventus, Marquisio and Pogba for parts of it. I wonder if there is a plan B there. Sarri doesn't really strike me as a sort of manager who's going to.
Well, it's because he's a little bit of an ideologue. He's a fundamentalist, isn't he? You know, like he believes in his form of football. So that feels like that's not that flexible. It might just be about finding, you know, four specific games, a way to get around those problems. What Champions League game are you at this week?
Spurs against Inter Milan on Wednesday.
So that's quite big now for Spurs. It's an important victory, which probably, would you say that secures them? We know that they're the third best team in the Premier League right now.
Spurs?
Yeah. Or do you not think that's secure?
No. I mean, I think Chelsea will come back. I mean, I think that Chelsea are still extremely decent. But Spurs definitely do seem to be on an upswing, and they've had their tough start, and they've kind of weathered it. So I suppose I think they'll be fine for the top four, possibly third.
And Chelsea, presuming, you know, it was a bad game, very bad game from them. But they've got a lot of points in the bank already, and you'd assume that they should get better under Sarri the longer that he's there. That's kind of the pattern we've seen before with him. So it's hard to see Manchester United sneaking into the top four, especially if they're going to play like they played against Crystal Palace on Saturday.
The other point about Sarri's Chelsea, which I think Jack made this morning, is that Sarri is a training ground manager, and he had a summer to work with them. He had them pretty well drilled, but now the remedial work is required, and they're playing Europa League every other week. They're playing Thursday, Sunday, and whether they're going to get that training ground time in order to work on their flaws in their system, that's going to be a real issue for them.
It was around this time of year that when Conte was in there, and they didn't have any European football whatsoever, he completely changed their system, didn't he? And found they went to the three at the back, and then that essentially won them the title that first year that Conte was there. Man United drew 0-0 with Crystal Palace. As dire a United attacking performance as you'd expect.
Good point. Good solid point for United.
Yeah, well,
really strong point. I mean, like, you know, people have had to go at Mourinho there. He's been getting brickbats all season, but like a solid home point against Crystal Palace, he's really, you know, it's shown his critics, I think.
Yeah, I think Palace 8 without a win now.
Have you seen Chesterfield?
No, tell me about Chesterfield.
So Chesterfield have drawn their last 8 games, and so they are simultaneously on their worst winless run I think for a long, long time.
And best undefeated.
And their best undefeated run in about 12 years. Little stat for you.
Very handy. And you know, big Saltergate people, big Saltergate listeners, I'm sure. Actually, they don't even play at Saltergate anymore. They've got a new stadium. But yeah, Chesterfield news. That'll be coming every week, that section for you. I don't know if you saw any other games. Arsenal dusted off Bournemouth. Great own goal in that. Jefferson Lerma's own goal.
Oh, spectacular.
Was as good as they come. Huddersfield against Wolves was a little bit of a surprise. But the most interesting game, I think, in terms of repercussions that we might feel this week was Fulham beating Southampton. Claudio Ranieri's first game in charge. And Mark Hughes is in all sorts, I think. What do you think of Mark Hughes as a manager?
Is it possible to have an opinion on Mark Hughes as a manager? Mark Hughes is a...
When was the last good job he did? He did well at Blackburn.
He did a good job at Blackburn. I think he did all right with Wales.
Yeah, Wales. But wasn't that...
He did all right at Fulham. And I think he did all right for two seasons at least at Stoke. I mean, finishing in ninth place in consecutive seasons with that Stoke team is... in retrospect, not a bad achievement. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the time, you only really realise how well a manager has done until you see the guy next after them have a go. He's not a bad manager. And if he were a bad manager, he wouldn't keep getting Premier League jobs. I know, like, we are straying into the realms of sort of one of the oldest and most boring football debates in the world. But Premier League chairmen, and especially Southampton, they're not idiots, are they?
Well, they're clearly that unhappy with how the football club has been run that they've just sacked the guy who was most important in the direction of the football club.
Les Reed, the director of football. Yeah, I mean, clearly it's a club that's not going in the right direction. But but
one of his last big decisions. I mean, they the last couple of managers they've hired have not worked out. Essentially, they hired Puel, and he did fine, but they didn't like him, so he went. They hired Pellegrino, who they really wanted to do well. Mm. But just, you know, didn't do well enough in that one season. And then Hughes comes in and...
Mark Hughes was hired to keep them up and he kept them up. And I don't...
He bristled. He was asked about the similarities of when he took over at QPR, mm-hmm. kept them up on the last day, like he did with Southampton. And then the next season got sacked. And he bristled at that and said that, no, this is a completely different job. Obviously, it's completely different circumstances. This squad is a different beast completely. But Southampton have gone from being a very stable sort of upper mid-table club to being in a fairly precarious position now. And they've got to make the right decision, basically, on the replacement for Les Reed. Do you have people making the full decisions at the club who you trust to make the right decisions? I don't know. But I'm watching Mark Hughes because I think if he goes, then who they hire next tells us a lot about what direction that club's heading in.
Yeah, if they hire Bob Bradley, then I think they're in trouble.
Well, it's even, or if they just hire some like a guy who's well known to be linked to, you know, for example, a certain powerful agent. It's it's the owners of that club saying, right, we're going to perhaps go down the Wolves model, or you know, there are certain clubs around Europe who have aligned themselves with agents, knowing that you are going to have to get in bed with the devil sometimes to do well, and then I think personally that it always comes back and bites you. I think there are plenty of examples of that.
The shame about the real shame about Southampton is that once you rip up that long term model, you can't get it back very easily. You are essentially trapped in a cycle of hand to mouth and occasionally hand to foot to mouth decisions, where every decision is really kind of a reaction to the last bad decision. And I think it would have been the enlightened thing to do for Southampton to say to Mark Hughes, look, you've kept us up. Thank you. Here is a little bit of money. Now run along and let's get a manager who actually wants to bring players through from the academy, who actually, you know, has slightly new ideas on football, who actually, you know, thinks about the game in a way that isn't quite tired. And Mark Hughes is just, you know, He is a man without verbs.
A man without verbs. I guess he's never been described as that before.
There's nothing to him. He's like really inclement weather.
Really inclement weather. This week is Champions League week, so I do want to touch on that. as you said, you're going to be...
Tottenham into Milan.
Tottenham into Milan. That's quite big.
Well, Tottenham, it's quite simple. Tottenham have to win or they're out. And I don't think they will. I don't think they
will. Why don't you think they will? Were you at the reverse leg?
Yeah. The one where they ironically played really, really badly, then took the lead, then started playing really well, then conceded two goals. And that, which is, that's a real lesson in football and life there. That's occasionally how it goes. They're on a bit of an up curve, Tottenham. I wonder how much Saturday night will have taken out of them mentally. And Inter, you know, they've been doing all right. They won at the weekend. They beat, I think, Frosinone, which I'm convinced isn't a real place, but they beat Frosinone. They are in and around, I think they're second or third, in and around the Serie A title race. Icardi got a good rest at the weekend. And there seems to be a culture, you know, in other countries of resting big players for league games and keeping them fresh for the Champions League. So I think,
well, in some countries they even move the fixtures to like a Friday night. So like Benfica were playing on a Friday night before their Champions League week, so they've got an even better chance of getting a result.
Yeah, there's not even an attempt to pretend that their domestic league is anywhere near as important as the Champions League, which, I, you know, it's a different way of doing it. I just don't ever see it happening in England.
I mean, not going to happen. Mourinho has complained about it before. I mean, Wenger complained about it. Every manager, I guess, in that position has complained about not having enough time. The other big games this week, PSG-Liverpool is now...
That's now huge.
Yeah. That's now a corker in that group because of how well Napoli have done. And, you know, imagine if PSG went out at the group stage of the Champions League.
Well, imagine if Liverpool went out at the Champions League group stages.
But that's... It's easier to envision almost because, you know, I think everyone knows last year was an overachievement. Mm. I think it would be very interesting for the Premier League title race if Liverpool went up the Champions League early.
Yes, I think sure. So. I think it's probably the best thing that can happen to them. But equally, they could win it. It's one of the most open. I know we say this a lot of years.
I don't think PSG and Liverpool are that different in quality. No, personally.
No, I mean, I would. Liverpool could go on a run and win it again. And I think that they certainly got a better chance than PSG, who, as we all know, will, if they qualify for the last 16 or the quarterfinals, will just go out.
A draw Real Madrid.
In extremely comical fashion against the first good team they come up against.
The other good game, so we've got Jack Pitbrook, who is en France. He's going to Lyon, Manchester City, and then he's getting the train up to Paris for PSG Liverpool.
It's a lovely train ride. Have you ever done that? Lyon to...
Yes. Did it during the Euros. I mean, you go through the Massif Central, you know.
Yeah, it's nice. Yes. Lyon, by the way, is
one of the great gastronomic cities.
That's amazing. It is better than Paris for me.
Yeah, love it. Rue Mercier, the cobbled street with all the restaurants on it.
There's I can't remember what you call it. Basically, like the local cuisine, which is sausage hot pots and all that kind of thing. And about 16 different kinds of mustard.
It's a terrific place. The stadium is a bit far out. You go to the new stadium there.
I'll tell you what happened. I went there during the Euros.
It looks like a spaceship.
I went to the wrong stadium. I went to the Gerland.
You went to the Gerland.
Oh. I went to the Gerland and had to very, very quickly double back on myself and almost miss kickoff.
I won't name who, but someone did that with cricket stadiums in Sri Lanka.
Oh, right.
Juventus Valencia is quite big for Manchester United, who play young boys. You'd like to think United could take care of young boys, but Juve Valencia, don't laugh at that. But Juve Valencia, it is big in that group as well. Bayern Munich Benfica is quite an interesting clash of two big clubs needing to do something. Atletico Madrid against Monaco, I'll be keeping an eye on as well. And then Thursday, you know, it's Europa, but
what's happening in the Europa League? I have no idea what's happening. Are Arsenal through? Are Chelsea through? What's happening? Celtic, Rangers, Everton? Are Everton in it?
Have you done any Europa League this year?
No. It's one of my red lines. I don't do Europa League. I don't do Carling Cup or whatever they're calling it now. And I don't do FA Cup up to and including the final.
Up to and including the final.
Never done an FA Cup final. It's one of the weird, you know, like
also rugby union
or rugby union. I have done rugby union in the past, but I've never done an FA Cup final. You know how Jack's never been to Old Trafford?
Yes.
And you are the only man with the power to send him there.
Yeah, and you know, I respect his beliefs. I think it's important to respect people's strong beliefs.
I think it's just a quirk of coincidence. Surely the cycle's got to be broken at some point.
He was close to going last year. And Arsenal pretty much won their group. They have 10 points from 4 games. Sporting a second. The other two teams in their group are Vorskla Poltava and Karabag. The Chelsea, as I believe they're technically called, mm-hmm. have won 4 from 4 in their group with PAOK Salonika, Bate Borisov and Vidi from Hungary. So, you know Vidi, the Orban team.
Yeah, the rapper.
I don't get that joke.
The
team of Viktor Orban.
Eminem's protege.
Vidi. That might well be a music reference that everyone else gets that I do not in the slightest. Rangers can still go through, by the way, in their group.
All right.
Real, Spartak Moscow, Rapid Vienna. That's all quite tight. Group F is interesting because Real Betis, AC Milan and Olympiacos are within a point of each other. And Dudelange are...
They're Luxembourg.
Yes. Yeah. They're on 0 points from 4 games with minus 10 goal difference.
Well, so really, what was the point of any of this? What was the point of any of that? So they've played 4 games each. That's, 72 football games,
mm-hmm.
lasting 6,840 minutes plus injury time.
Yeah, good maths.
And what have we learned from any of that? What good has any of that done anybody? Except, you know, Dudelange, who...
There are a couple of richer clubs, which is how you basically have to gauge these things in Europe as to expectations, who might end up going out. Celtic are one of those. Bordeaux are one of those. Anderlecht are one of those. Also, remember, you know, knocked out of the Belgian Cup by Union Saint-Gilloise of the second division earlier this season.
But then so what? You know, like, you get out of your Europa League group, Group L or Group Kappa or you know, Group Omega or whatever they're called, and then you make it to the last 32, plonk, Valencia, you're out.
So, for you, is the Europa League sub-Copa Libertadores?
Yeah, very much. I don't even know the format of the Copa Libertadores, but I think the
Europa
League...
Group stage, then 2 legs, knockout all the way through.
Yeah, you know what? There's kind of romance.
For the final time.
There's a romance to it. But the Europa League is just, it's far too long. It needs to be straight knockout, if anything.
And because, they're going to bring in a third competition, obviously, because the Europa League is not low enough. They're bringing in another tier of UEFA competitions. That's Seferin's new idea.
That sounds absolutely delightful.
We should talk about the Libertadores very briefly. If only as an introduction to the segment, which everyone's about to listen to, that's come from Buenos Aires, which I believe should be Miguel Delaney, accompanied by New York Times' Rory Smith, Wall Street Journal's Joshua Robinson, and freelance extraordinaire, but the man who literally wrote the book on Argentina, Jonathan Wilson.
By the way, none of whom I would imagine have made the mistake that I've been making my entire life, which is pronouncing it Conmebol.
Well, it's Conmebol, yeah.
It's Conmebol. I didn't realise that. That's the level of knowledge that I'm working with here.
But broadly speaking...
Very broadly speaking.
Very broadly speaking. So, like, on a specific level first, when the away team has their bus attacked and players are injured to the point that it would be detrimental to their performance, do you think that the away team should be handed victory?
Not in all circumstances. I mean, I think if the away team are in a fit state to play, then... by all means, get the game on and issue appropriate sanctions afterwards. In this case, it looks like River, Boca.
Boca were attacked. River were at home.
Boca were attacked. Yeah, it looked like they were in no fit state to play because,
correct, yeah.
You know, people had glass in their eyes and they were all retching and vomiting.
And stuff, yeah.
Carlos Tevez was retching even more than usual. And so... clearly, the game couldn't go ahead in that circumstance. Generally, though, you do want to play the game if at all possible, as long as it can be done fairly and you know.
I think there's an argument that they, you know, they shouldn't play it now, and they because the whole thing, everyone virtually involved has disgraced themselves to the extent that you know the kind of the competition.
Well, the clubs haven't disgraced themselves, have they?
The political stuff behind the scenes has been pretty poor. And
was it definitely River fans?
Yes.
Not like Boca fans dressed up as River fans.
No, it was very much River fans. I just think it's you know, it is a shame because it would have been so great. And obviously that's why we sent Miguel out there, because it should have been like one of the most memorable football matches you'd ever seen. And instead, you get no game. And they can't even postpone it a couple of days. You know, we could have kept him out there until like Wednesday night if it was Wednesday night. But this week is the G20 summit in Buenos Aires. So all of the most important political leaders in the world are going to be in Buenos Aires. So they need the police for that, not stupid football fans smashing windows and all that sort of stuff. So it could be weeks until the game, which still doesn't have a date. But anyway, I'm sure you'll get more of this detail.
How on earth does Argentina get in the G20, by the way? And Spain doesn't?
It's the eighth largest country in the world by size.
Right, so why is Kazakhstan not in it? Or Mongolia? Or Sudan? Or Algeria?
Because they're not as big regional
or
powers.
Antarctica.
Argentina is one of the most influential regional powers in Central and South America.
Antarctica should be in the G20.
Well, Antarctica, they argue over, you know, that's the whole point, isn't it? That's why they go to the G20 to argue about things like who owns that slice of the Arctic Circle.
The Antarctic delegation, which would be like one scientist and one penguin.
But I guess the problem is no one comes from Antarctica either. It's always, there's like American scientists.
There's a jail. You know, there's a prison in Antarctica.
I did not know that.
The Antarctic research station. And generally, it's Russians who get sent loads, you know, get sent vodka, and there's nothing to do out there but get incredibly drunk. Mm-hmm. And there is like a very rudimentary police force out there. And I think...
prone to corruption, you'd say. If there are ten people, if you're the policeman and you just don't get on with one of the guys, it's like you just put them in the slammer for a couple of nights.
I'd take it up with the High Commission in Santiago, 4,000 miles away. Yeah.
We'll get something back by next Wednesday. Until then, you're in the slammer.
Yeah. But anyway.
So there you go. That's Antarctica, G20, and a lot more.
Chesterfield. What a pod.
And it's not even over. So keep listening for the guys from Buenos Aires. But until next time, that is it from me and from Jonathan. Jonathan, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening, as always. And if you have the time, just rate, review, subscribe, and tell a friend. This has been the Indie Football Podcast. Thank you, and goodbye.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Indie Podcast. From a different venue and a different lineup this week. We're here in the Monumental in Buenos Aires, 50 minutes before the second scheduled kickoff time for the second leg of the Copa Libertadores. Or is it the fourth or fifth?
Hang on, one, two, three, four.
Six. Okay, yeah. Anyway, the point being, we're in an empty Monumental where the game is not taking place. I'm here with Josh Robinson of the Wall Street Journal, Jonathan Wilson of the Guardian and Sports Illustrated, and Rory Smith of the New York Times, friends of the Independent. we're kind of trying to just, I suppose, register what and how all of this happened, and ultimately how CONMEBOL and Argentinian football made a mess of what was supposed to be their big, almost re-announcement game, what you'd call it. I mean, something to finally match the brain drain, economic drain to Europe and the Champions League.
Yeah, it felt like an almost unique occasion where, for once, for all that, like Spurs, Chelsea, and Barca, Atleti were big games, it felt like the eyes of the world were kind of on Buenos Aires, on South America, on River Boca, and everyone involved has blown it. Essentially, yep. The ultimate blame, I guess, lies with the River fans who attacked the bus, which started the whole problem. But then there's the way it was policed. There was the fact they fired the tear gas, which then got into the bus. There's question marks in Argentina, apparently, about the relationship between the police and the Ministry of Justice. There's the endless delays and announcements and the kind of Machiavellian machinations of of the rescheduling, and then we all come back today, and it doesn't happen again. And it doesn't happen again half an hour after River had opened the gates to the stadium and announced the game was on. It's insane.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, it's just a mess. I've flown 7,000 miles to watch a game not happen twice.
Yeah.
And yeah, from a journalistic point of view, we've probably got more out of it because nothing happened.
Yeah, it's a good story, generally.
But it's a disaster for Argentinian football, and it's embarrassing for CONMEBOL. And I think what's actually mildly encouraging is Alejandro Dominguez, the president of CONMEBOL, at least his statement today. I mean, it's too late, obviously, but at least his statement today, you could hear the kind of controlled rage in his voice. He was furious about what's happened, and he was saying that we have to look at ourselves. So hopefully this will mean CONMEBOL do look at themselves and do look at how they can handle this kind of situation differently. But at the same time, you sort of think, well, this goes so further beyond CONMEBOL. This is outside their control. They can't expect to control the police. They can't expect to control the Argentinian Ministry of Justice. They can't be expected to manage the societal issues that lead to the relationship between Argentinian football and violence. I mean, there's been the terrible thing, the tragedy for Argentinian football is what happened yesterday barely registers in the scale of their trouble. There have been 93 people killed in Argentinian football-related violence in the last decade. There have been 328 killed since 1922. Those are ridiculous numbers.
Mm.
And that's something way beyond a bureaucrat sitting in an office in Asuncion to sort out.
And, you know, when was the last time that the Copa Libertadores final sort of mattered on a global football scale? Yeah. You know, it's the reason we're all here is because this was unique and because it was Boca River. And we get to a point now where this is what they've shown the world through, as Rory said, the fault of all sorts of different parties. Now the game, when it happens, wherever it happens, we don't know. There's still no formal date for it, but it has to happen sometime before the Club World Cup in mid-December, presumably. You know, now we're at a point now where we're all going to go home.
Yeah.
No one really cares about the outcome of the game anymore, except maybe people here. And what we take away from it is a game that didn't happen twice.
Yeah.
That Argentine football and South American football feels like it's in chaos.
Yeah.
It's lived up to a lot of really unfortunate stereotypes. And we haven't seen any football.
What's really sad is we've been here for, 4 days?
Yeah.
Feels like a lifetime. It's been a lovely holiday.
Don't say that.
hasn't been a holiday.
12 to 14-hour working days. That is true. That is true.
But we've spoken to people around Argentinian football and South American football. We've done work.
Yeah.
And you go to Racing, you go to San Lorenzo, you go to these clubs, and you speak to people, and they're a good people doing good work, and they want to improve things, and that's not true at every club, and it's not true of every person at every club, but there are people working hard, and they're in this context where now all of that basically goes out the window. Jonathan's right, this isn't, in terms of the scale of the attack on the Boca bus, this is not a serious incident for Argentina, as stupid as that sounds. There have been more serious incidents this week in Argentina than this, in terms of the actual nature of it. But all the world will see, yet again, is kind of, well, South America doesn't help itself, it's chaos, it's mayhem, you know, everyone's incompetent.
Mm.
And that, it's really sad. They've been using the word shame a lot
in Argentina. Yeah, yeah.
They're really ashamed of what's happened.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly sad. And journalistically, it's a great, this horrible sort of parasitic existence we have. It's a great story. This is an incredible story to have covered. It has been a remarkable kind of adrenaline pumping 2 days. But it's so sad.
Nothing gets adrenaline flowing like sitting in an empty stadium watching nothing happen while nobody tells you anything.
and the Wi-Fi won't connect to your laptop.
It's just a you problem.
Yeah. And Jonathan had it as well. But I mean, although one of the main...
Just to pick up what Roy was saying about the tragedy. You know, we spent time at Racing on Friday, and we're talking about youth development and all the great things they're doing with that. But if you're you're a 17-year-old, 18-year-old Argentinian kid who's good at football, and you're sort of like at the back of your mind, you're sort of thinking, well, I'm probably going to move to Europe sooner rather than later. But you think, no, you know, this is home. This is a comfortable environment. This is a good place to learn the game. Maybe I'll stay here for 2 or 3 more years. I'll go when I'm sort of 20, 21, a bit more mature. You see something like this, they can't even put a game on. They can't even put on the biggest game in the continent's history in terms of global audience. Yeah. They can't even get that right. Why am I going to stay here rather than going to Shakhtar Donetsk, to China, to wherever? And that's the other problem Argentinian football has. Since 1926, when Liberati first moved to Italy, Argentinian football has been an export culture. But it was controlled, and they were going to big clubs in big European leagues. And now they're going to Mexico, to the US, to Japan, to China, to Ukraine. It's not even just Portugal, Spain, Italy.
Yeah.
It is leagues that Argentina, historically, have been much bigger than.
It's quite nice, actually, as we're recording. There's two guys in white T-shirts. I think they're from Fox Sports, the broadcaster. And it turns out that after all this, four match days, because obviously the first leg was delayed as well, about 84 kickoff times, just those two guys have got the Libertadores trophy, and they've just disappeared with it down into the stands.
So. I'd like a photo op with it.
Yes, we all would. Someone has to lift it, and it should be you, given your 12 to 14 hour working days.
But one of the things that struck, particularly about when we went to Racing, and Racing are obviously, and we'd all do pieces of this over the next few weeks, given the time they gave us, but Racing are trying to, they've taken, Diego Milito's come back with basically a European model, which is genuinely very distinctive and rare in Argentine football. And it's like they finally applied thought to Argentine football. But this is a massive issue, that it's probably the most emotional football culture I've ever seen. And and the sense you get is that they're so emotional about it. When it comes to something like this, something staging it, to reflecting on results, they just can't keep it in. They can't contain any of it. There's no... But ultimately, as you said yesterday, they care about football too much. And I even came across on Thursday night, we were on our way back from another meeting. From the Boca training, from the Boca training, and a taxi driver said to us, sincerely, I would sell my soul to win on Saturday. I don't care. Again,
sell my soul to the devil.
Yeah, sell my soul to the devil.
Not just to anyone.
And I suppose that's it. I mean, and we were there at Boca on Thursday. We took all those great images, lovely photos of what was, you know, a kind of a gloriously chaotic scene. But yeah, but there was a flip side to that, though. I mean, even right in front of us was that fan trying to climb over a 15-foot glass wall
to go into an even busier section of the stadium.
It was mental. In that scene we were at, a lot of it was quite dangerous, actually.
Yeah, when we tried to get out, we basically took a wrong turn, and we ended up going up to the top tier among the fans, which was a fantastic experience. The atmosphere was amazing. But we eventually decided we should probably get to where the press area was meant to be, not least as my phone was out of battery. And we tried to get out and couldn't.
Yeah.
And this was for a training session. The stairwells were full. The corridors were full. There was very little kind of policing.
People trying to cram in as well.
People trying to cram in. And as soon as we kind of left, Miguel led the way and sort of went through. People poured into the space we'd left. And there was a point at which you thought, right, well, I'm going back down these stairs now. And this is all... I felt quite guilty. I put a video on Twitter that got how many views, Miguel?
I don't know. The last update you gave me was, 2.2 million or something like that?
3.2
million. All right. Good to know.
I went viral. And you do... You come as a European or a North American and you take all these brilliant images of this colour and this noise and this passion that really appeals to you and that is seductive. And it's easy to kind of get fetishize it and to romanticize it. But there's another side to it completely, and that's the side we've seen in the last 48 hours, which is the side that basically, takes football too seriously, where winning matters much.
I mean,
that runs through all of Argentina's football culture.
It was a point that Diego Huerta at Racing made to us, basically. It applies to everything, even when it comes down to managers, that, you know, clubs don't have to react to one or two bad results, get rid of them, and that runs through everything.
Managers at youth level.
At youth level.
And in a sense, that's kind of what we came for as well. That's what made this special. And
The histrionics
and also the idea that we were hoping for, like, you know, maybe subconsciously, sort of a very specific level of mayhem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This went too far.
We didn't get a game.
Exactly, we didn't get a game. But it's that idea of, as Rory said, this sort of fetishized band of mayhem where it's like quite much higher than anything we get in Europe. Mm. But without going into a space where we don't get a game. But what we've kind of learned here is that these neuroses around loving football too much or to this level are incredibly layered and sort of run so deep. I was talking to a Boca fan who was telling me that, yes, he wanted Boca to come win at Rivers Stadium, but that it might ruin football for him in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this would be the as he put it, el máximo.
Yeah, yeah. But and the vibe very much for a game of such massive excitement and hype and hope, I suppose, that what really
and
stood.
Dread.
Yeah, yeah. But that's what it was. So what really stood out in the build up was. Basically, this, I think someone described it to me as the most unwelcome Super Classic ever, because really what it came down to was the cost of failure weighed heavier than the potential benefit of victory.
Yeah. And I think then you have to... To say that Argentines love football too much, it's true, but you then have to... There's an obvious supplementary question, which is why? Why have they got nothing else? Why have they got... Why here? Why... Why has it supplanted all of the things by which people find meaning in their lives? And I think it's to do with partly to do with the horrendous economic situation that Argentina finds itself in, that a lot of people have very few aspirations.
To cut across on that, one of the reasons we found that people wanted River to win over Boca was because of Boca's association with Macri. That became such a kind of an underlying theme to the build-up.
I think for neutrals, that might be true, yeah.
It was really interesting, though, everyone who supported another team other than River or Boca wanted River to win.
Yeah. I mean, Boca are a little bit insufferable with ubiquity.
Yeah.
I think the Macri thing we probably should explain to people. Macri used to be the president of Boca. A lot of his political support and support base came through Boca. And yet Boca is the working class club, historically, and Macri is a proto-Thatcher or quasi-Thatcherite who's imposed a massive austerity programme on Argentina. You might argue necessarily.
Not working.
And it's not working, yeah.
Inflation's running out of control.
And people are just angry in general, so it doesn't take very much for that to spill over in all of its forms, whether that's sports or otherwise.
Yeah, but the other thing that's really important is that this isn't a new thing, as Jonathan kind of highlighted. So there must be like a sociological and a economic explanation for it, but it's not for all that Macri's policies aren't working. It's not Macri's. Macri's fault.
I don't want to go on too much about my book, Angels of Dirty Faces. Angels of Dirty Faces. But I think one of the
very long that book.
Yeah, it is. But if you near the start. about 100 pages
in. It was a long flight here, so we all had time to read it.
But I think one of you often get people talking about how the way a national team plays is somehow representative of a sort of national character. And I think a lot of the time that's pretty bogus or pretty contrived. I think with Argentina, maybe not so much now, but certainly go back in the 1920s, that relationship was very, very direct. Argentina was a new country, a country which had nothing to bind it. When the First War began, there were a million Spaniards, 800,000 Italians, 400,000 Northern European Jews, 400,000 Arabs, 40,000 Brits and Irish, 30,000 Germans, 30,000 French here. These were people with nothing in common. And the thing that bound them was they all supported the same football team. So I think football here has always given people an identity in a much more powerful and much more... It's on a foundational level in a way you don't find elsewhere, where religion or job or region would give you that identity.
But I mean, that's one of the interesting things about it. I mean, having written the book on it, when did it first become anyway noticeable or tangible, this extra level of histrionics? I mean, even like just to cut across for a second, Argentina's match against Nigeria in the World Cup. I wasn't at that. I think you three guys were.
I've never
experienced, even from TV,
I wasn't at Nigeria.
A match of such, you know, unbearable tension for any international team.
But that's where it starts. I mean, the first football-related death, Salvemos al Football, which is this sort of lobbying group to try and improve football and make it safer. They dated 1922. When a child was killed at a game between Sporting Barracas, which is a team I don't think exists anymore, certainly not in the top two divisions. They played a Basque touring team, and a kid fell off a horse-drawn cart and was killed. Others were dated 1926, when Argentina played Uruguay, and a Uruguayan fan was shot in Montevideo by an Argentinian fan. And the story then goes that the Argentina team helped smuggle him out of Montevideo on their boat.
Right.
Now, proving the truth of that, this for me was very difficult, but it is certainly true that a Uruguayan fan was killed in the aftermath of an Argentinian football defeat. So this has been there very, very early. In terms of Abbas Bravas, the hooligans, I think that's a thing probably from the late 60s, 70s. And it began with away fans travelling with teams almost as protection, like to, because home fans would attack the team. So they then started taking thugs with them, essentially, to protect them. And that initially was, if not healthy, at least kind of not as malign as it is now.
Yeah.
And increasingly, that got a hooligan element attached to it. And you then get the incredibly difficult and complicated relationship of Abbas Bravas with organised crime. So a lot of the violence we've seen recently in Argentinian football, I don't think it's related to what happened yesterday, but a lot of the violence you've seen recently in Argentinian football is actually intra-Barra rivalry between the same club. That the Barra, the organised crime, they moved out of the clubs because the clubs weren't profitable, there's no money to be had. And then when you had the Football Paratados program brought in by Cristina Kirchner, which suddenly increased the television revenues they got by, I think, fivefold, suddenly there was money. And so the old Barra moved back in to try and get back at that cash. And they find that a new Barra has grown up. And so they were clashing. So they had, I think about 10 years ago, they put in stadiums this thing they call lungs. So basically segregation with big gaps between home fans and away fans. And it turned out to make no difference at all, because what was happening was home fans were fighting home fans.
Yeah, yeah.
So away fans have been banned since 2013. That ban was lifted partially in August, although not for games involving the big five clubs. Mm. It's a massive problem, and I think the fact that it's not just one club fighting another club, but different factions of one club fighting each other, suggests to what extent this is not really football's problem. This is a societal problem that essentially football is... The stuff football can do, but it's so much bigger than football.
Well, football is the vent, isn't it? That's what Ezequiel
Fernandez Moore's... Yeah, it's a stage at which these things are played.
Without being too crude about it, it is essentially a country with less in it to vent. Basically, football is... dominates so much.
Well, no, but then, so I spoke to an Argentinian, a well-respected Argentinian journalist. I don't know if he would want to be quoted. I'm not going to name him, but who said that if you look across the world, in a lot of countries there is a way in which that country releases its violence.
Yeah,
and so the best example is in the States, where you get a quite staggering amount of gun crime.
Yeah, yeah.
Compared to every other country, you know, the number of deaths in the States from gun crime every year outstrips all of those suffered in Europe or something in the last 30. And he said, well, look, football in Argentina serves that function. This is where this society releases its violence. Now, that's not to condone it or to say that it's okay, or we should let it, you know, we should let them get on with it. But it perhaps is a reminder that Argentina isn't a uniquely violent society. Yeah. That these problems exist elsewhere. It's just that they manifest in different ways in different countries. Yeah. And it just so happens that here, and not only here, in a lot of Eastern Europe, I'm sure one of us has written a book on Eastern Europe. probably his best book.
Yeah. And most human book, I'd say.
Most human book, yeah.
It's called Behind the Curtain.
Yeah. It is no longer available.
It's definitely available. It has not sold out.
But it just happens that football has become a vehicle kind of worldwide for that. But I think what's really interesting, what lends Argentina a unique context, is what we were talking about before, that sense that winning is all that matters.
Yeah.
Which means that there is... It's maybe not worse here, it's maybe not more prevalent here, but it just seems much more kind of endemic and also kind of accepted here that this is the way life is. And no one is going to do anything about it.
And to circle back to what Miguel brought up about the national team is that it creates this feedback
loop. Yeah.
I mean, the players, and especially the managers, wear the weight of that of the whole culture on their sleeve. I've never seen a manager more miserable than Sampaoli in Russia this summer.
Yeah.
I mean, he would come out after an adverse result and wear it on his face, look like, you know, his dog had died.
Yeah. He transformed into a joke, Shatter. Like, quite previously respected.
You could see the kind of really sort of sickly sweats he got on that Nigeria game. He came out after half time and he looked like a man about to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
So speaking of managers, one person I think who has come out of the last 24, 48 hours with credit is Marcelo Gallardo, the River manager, who, from what we can tell, I mean, who knows what he's saying behind closed doors, but from what we can tell, he appears to be entirely amenable to whatever Boca wanted. So, this has got to be done right. We don't want to play here, and I think he deserves immense credit for that.
Just a note on Gallardo, though, he didn't deserve credit in the semi-finals when he was accused of spying on Gremio.
Or indeed in the semi-final between Boca and River in 2004 when he was sent off in the first leg for strangling the Boca goalkeeper. Yeah.
But he's had a great weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is the other thing. So this is not the first bit of ridiculousness for the Libertadores this year.
So there was
the semi-final that really should have been thrown out of.
So that's a point I wanted to raise, basically. I mean, in terms of... I mean, first of all, there was an argument that... River shouldn't even have been here at all. But in terms of what now they are here, how do we feel about this? What's going to happen next? What should have happened? I mean, I think I'm of the view, even though I really wanted to see a game, it's quite a weird feeling now that I'm actually not too bothered. I'm not going to see a game because of everything that's happened. It's quite strange given the excitement they came with. But I actually think River should have been thrown out of the competition for the second time. And Boca should have been awarded the trophy. How do we feel about what's going to happen?
I think for the third time, let's not forget that he fielded Zuccolini in the last 16. He was still suspended from a game, I think, 5 years ago before he came back here. And the only reason they weren't banned was because Racing, although they were saying their club would do things in the right way, they forgot to put in their appeal within the 24-hour window. So River were banged to rights today and got away with it. They were banged to rights in the semi-final and got away with it. I mean... Can they get away with it the third time?
It's interesting, actually. We also spoke to Alejandro Dominguez, the president of CONMEBOL.
Yeah, that was on Friday.
Who was talking about how he doesn't believe in coincidences ahead of the Boca River Derby. Given that River have basically been let off scot-free twice, that is an interesting turn of phrase. But look, morally, the right thing for everyone to do is for River to be forced to forfeit the game and Boca to be given the trophy. That isn't what will happen, I'm pretty sure, but that is morally the right thing to do, because the fans have to learn, not just River, it's not just them, they have to learn there are consequences, that if you do that stuff, and you shouldn't do that you shouldn't throw stuff at buses. This is something we learned in Liverpool in March, April. Don't throw stuff at buses. It's really
easy. Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I threw something at a bus.
There was the potential for, they mentioned the scene yesterday of Perez with a bandage in his eye picking up the trophy after no game had taken place in front of livid River. I mean, it was imaginable but not advisable.
Perez, who clearly had glass in his eye, but the CONMEBOL doctor had decided, I see no medical reason why the game shouldn't go ahead.
Actually, I'm not sure he did have glass in his eye. If you read what his ophthalmologist said, he implied it was damage caused by the gas rather than by glass.
Okay.
So he had a significant eye problem, I think it was gas-related, not glass-related.
He had conjunctivitis, didn't he?
He said he had... Yeah, and corneal...
Ruptures or something.
It sounded bad, anyway.
But look, there's no question that River should be thrown out. That is how this should work. And it's Boca, I think, have pointed out to CONMEBOL that that's what happened in 2015 when there was pepper spray released by Boca fans onto the River players. The difference in this case is that the damage took place outside the stadium, so I think River probably have a case to say, look, we can't control everyone the whole time.
Well,
that is legitimate.
Also, the gas wasn't...
Well, we don't know.
Well, we don't know who released the gas. If it was the police, then the crime is the breaking of the bus window.
Yeah,
right.
And like, let's be honest, if you kick out every team who breaks a bus window in the Libertadores, you're gonna have like three teams.
Yeah,
left,
but equally, so. If you, it's the old kind of get a yellow card in early from the referee to lay down the law, isn't it?
Yeah.
Equally, if you in the final of the Libertadores, the biggest game in South American history, if you say the punishment for attacking the bus is that we'll play it at a later date and you might still win,
but
then you're condoning it.
But this is the thing, that all the talk has been of South America and Argentine football putting on their big exhibition, but maybe this should have been actually the opportunity now to set an example.
This I think should be, in a competent organisation, and it's a test of CONMEBOL's competence, should be a watershed. They should say this will not happen. The other thing Dominguez said to us is that he will not tolerate any more violence. Here's your chance.
Well, and now CONMEBOL is going to meet on Tuesday in Paraguay at their headquarters and discuss when to set this game, but you would think that there's going to be some talk of discipline as well.
I
mean,
there's got to be some kind of sanction,
exactly,
whatever, and that is, but I mean, there has to be some kind of sanction.
And they decided that they were going to have this game today, by the way, with all the fans. There wasn't even talk of playing it behind closed doors. So they were just going to postpone it by 24 hours and do it all over again.
It was just the glamour of the occasion. And the fact we're here is probably testament to that as well. That we also got, it happened to us, but it seduced everyone to the point where kind of a lot of logic was clouded. We have to this game has to take place.
Yeah.
Right, and it didn't help matters, I'm sure, that, Dominguez had Infantino, the FIFA president, looking over his
shoulder.
Saying, allegedly, I mean, according to sort of the Argentine press.
And Gago game, and Tevez.
Yeah, that this game has to go ahead. Mm. Even though FIFA technically has no jurisdiction over CONMEBOL.
Well, it's nothing to do with FIFA. It doesn't make, for all that it's really easy to use FIFA as a whipping boy for everything, and often justified. If the game doesn't go ahead, it's not FIFA's fault.
No. Yeah.
It's not. It doesn't reflect badly on them. This isn't a FIFA competition. Mm. This is a CONMEBOL competition. It's their problem. But as Josh says, it's not great that every time Dominguez was presented with the president of River or the president of Boca or the players or the medical staff, he'd have been looking over his shoulder, and this sort of very shiny Swiss man would have been, Alejandro, what are you going to do? this is a tricky one, isn't it?
But he did describe him as his great friend on Force on Friday.
He did, yeah.
What he should have done was get a ball with loads of plastic balls inside. Go on, have a play with that.
As we leave a very oddly serene Monumental.
Very peaceful now.
Yeah, 1978 World Cup final took place, of course. You can read about that in Jonathan's book.
Yeah, that goal over there is where Fijol made the famous save. That goal over there is where Kempes scored.
He's just pointed at both goals. Yeah.
he's done that on an audio medium because he doesn't actually know which one's which.
No, I know that one because that's the one nearest where the
he's pointing to the left one, which will make no sense to you. The temptation is to get a ball and kick that into that net, isn't it?
There's been quite a lot.
It would be the only ball kicked at the moment. This week.
Quite a lot of the TV crew have been clearing up, have taken the chance to like kiss the turf. So it's obviously a place of great religion, and also the TV crew clearly is biased.
Yeah. And on that, thank you for joining us. Well, will we see you at the second leg then?
A third leg,
yeah. All right, thank you. Good luck. Oh, buenas noches.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.